Roush stood before an enormous set of double doors. They were made of steel or some other type of metal, looking to be electroplated as well. They were massive, with some type of sensors. He was uncertain of their purpose. They were mounted into the living rock. There was a video camera. Its housing appeared antique. There were combination dials on the doors. He had seen photographs of such devices. They were not electronic, had to be worked precisely to open unless the doors they sealed were blown down. The Japanese lay in a heap before the doors, unconscious or dead. The doors were closed. Rush's fists balled closed, then open, then closed again. His stomach still churned from the descent. He was slightly affected by heights, always had been, usually conquered the fear more easily. He walked toward the man he'd left in charge, stared into his gray eyes for a long moment, then backhanded him across the mouth with his open hand, driving the man to his knees.
Idiot!
Roush turned to stare at the doors. Michael Rourke stood in the open entrance for the airlock of the hermetically sealed tent. Maria Lloyden shivered beside him. A J-7V was going airborne. Impulsively, Michael Rourke waved after it, wondering if he would ever see his mother again, ever know the child she carried in her womb.
Michael?
You're cold. I'll take you inside.
Oh, I love you, Michael.
Michael Rourke turned toward her and held her in his arms. She raised her head, her lips slightly parted. He bent his face over hers, looking into her eyes for a moment. They were beautiful eyes.
I love you, Michael.
She pressed her body against him, and he closed his coat around them. He held her as his gaze moved toward the night sky, the J-7V's running lights all but lost in the swirling snow surrounding the tent, filling the night. In moments, with Rolvag, a small team of German commandos, and a unit of volunteers who survived the Soviet assault on Hekla Base, he would go into the night. Rolvag, as best they could understand him, told of something that might have been tunnels, lava flows that led beneath the cone. Michael Rourke kissed Maria Lloyden. Her lips touched at his cheek. He could barely hear her.
I love you, Michael Rourke.
I love you, Maria Lloyden.
He held her very tight. Someone would come, tell him it was time to move out. He would wait until then, holding her. Paul Rubinstein could tell he had more stamina. In the tropics, the air was more dense, more oxygen-rich, and despite the generally thinned atmosphere, the correlation held true. Physical activity was easier. He reached a rise above the ridge. Below him, he saw the trailing edge of a column of men disappearing behind a wall of trees. Another column was clearly visible, the column of smoke. He would reach it before these men, whoever they were, reached it. He stopped and uncased the German binoculars. He still couldn't see what lay at the base of the column of smoke, what its origin might be, because it originated above his current position. Paul cased the binoculars and ran on. What a peaceful scene, he thought. A jungle filling up with snow, snow that might be radioactive. John used his gunship's sensors to make atmospheric samplings. They showed negative results, but there was always a chance the snow in some new cloud might contain radioactive dust particles. And why was it snowing where normally, what was normal, he didn't really remember, where normally the weather was eternal summer?
Skiing on the beach at Waikiki. Huh.
The sensors monitoring the network of automatic electronic systems that kept track of the mechanical condition of the gunship and protected it from tampering with everything from electrical charges through the gunship's skin to an explosive device equivalent in impact to several sticks of dynamite also served as a perimeter alarm. The German gunship's perimeter alarm system was activated now. Rourke put down the gunship's shop manual, but with the aid of a solid dictionary and the video display supplement that overlaid one system into another and put the systems into motion where appropriate, it was intelligible. He stood up, flipped the control panel switch to begin warming the synth oil in the crankcase, then peered through the plexiglass where the snow covering allowed. The interior surface of the glass-like substance was designed to resist fogging. It seemed to do that well. He supposed someone not born in the 20th century would simply have activated the video displays fed from the cameras mounted beneath the main rotor, rather than just try to look out something as ordinary as a window. But old habits died hard. He saw nothing. This didn't console him. One of the scoremasters in his right fist, he sat at the consoles and began activating the gunship systems for takeoff. Before the night of the war, a constant source of amusement for him had been movies in which the hero or bad guy ran up to an aircraft sitting unattended on some lonely runway, jumped behind the controls, switched on the engines, and took off, just as someone might have done with an automobile. He checked the video monitoring system. There was movement farther downstream, shifting patches of black amid the green of the leaves and the white of the snow. He checked systems, his attention alternating from the control panels to the video monitors. Paul carried with him one of the German individual field radios. About the size of the Motorola units 20th century police officers carried, it attached to the belt, wires traveling up along the torso. The wires ended in a small vibration-sensitive unit that could transmit or receive human speech, giving the unnerving feeling that someone was alternately behind your back or reading your mind. Paul probably wasn't wearing it. Rourke activated the radio.
This is John. Come in, Paul. Do you read me? Over.
Paul was supposed to contact the gunship once he reached the source of the smoke. They agreed on nothing else. Rourke glanced again at the monitors.
Paul, this is John. Do you read me? Over.
They had agreed to maintain radio silence, since if Paul found hostile personnel, the sound of an incoming transmission, however slight, might be detected, might betray him. Rourke was beginning to think that had been a bad idea. The black patches amid the bright green leaves and stark whiteness of the snow were black uniforms, men with assault rifles. The uniforms John Rourke instantly recognized, Soviet Marine Spetsnaz from the Soviet underwater complex.
Shit.
On the plus side, if they were on the island to begin with, they had to have a purpose that somehow likely involved Midwake personnel. To contact Midwake personnel in order to secure help or information in the search for Annie and Natalia and Otto Hammerschmidt was the objective of the mission. The gunship was ready to fly, able to be taken airborne in under 60 seconds. If he started the rotors so he could get airborne instantly, he could at least alert the Marine Spetsnaz personnel observing the gunship, perhaps scare them off. With any luck, they had never seen a helicopter in the flesh before and wouldn't instantly be 100% certain what to do to a helicopter to immobilize it. It would be difficult for their small-caliber rifles to immobilize the gunship at any event, unless a stray shot hit just the right place on just the right portion of the helicopter. Of course, there were always RPGs to consider, and Rourke had no idea either what the range of an island-class submarine's deck guns might be.
Guess I'm gonna find out.
The men in the black uniforms were moving, six men in a classic skirmish line, coming up from downstream only. If any more were hidden upstream or on either side of the shoals, Rourke could not see them. Chances were very good these men had never seen a gunship in action, had no idea of its capabilities. Intrinsic to victory was knowledge of the enemy's weaknesses and strengths. Intrinsic to the communications system of the gunship was a public address capability. There was an obvious weakness he could exploit. Mechanically, he checked all systems, armed the helicopter's miniguns. The six men were moving just as they had been, approximately 100 yards downstream from the gunship. One of them might notice the video cameras mounted beneath the main rotor following them. He doubted that. 90 yards. 75 yards. He cut power to the helicopter skin, killing all passive defense systems except video monitoring. Mentally, John Rourke ticked off the seconds. If the pace of the Marine Spetsnaz personnel advancing against the machine remained constant, they were 90 seconds from the gunship's starboard fuselage door. What they had in mind to do when they reached it was another question.
80.
His eyes alternated between the sweep second hand of the black-faced Rolex Submariner on his left wrist and the instruments and monitors.
70.
If anything, the six men were slowing their pace. Were they reluctant to approach out of a lack of knowledge of the machine's capabilities? He thought so.
60.
John Rourke powered up main and tail rotor controls. Snow swirled around the craft in a gigantic cloud, momentarily obscuring the picture provided by the video cameras beneath the main rotor. Rourke eyed the pressure gauges, tachometers.
50.
As Rourke's video returned, he could see the six Marine Spetsnaz personnel were scattering. One of them, evidently an officer or senior non-com, trying to rally the men.
30 seconds, Paul. This is John. Do you read me? If you cannot respond verbally, open and close transmission. Over. 15 seconds.
Almost enough power. He checked the arming status on his weapons pods in case one of the enemy personnel had an RPG strapped on his back. Weapons pods, port, starboard, fore and aft, were armed. 5 seconds remained. power was adequate if he ate up seconds by spinning machine on its axis, which would look forbidding to the Soviet personnel at any event, he hoped. He let the gunship slip to port as it rose into the air. The helicopter turned a full 360 degrees. Snow blew in a cyclone beneath it. The Soviet personnel were hammered back by the force of wind-driven snow, gravel from the shoals, spray of icy water as Rourke climbed, banked slightly, and skipped rotor blade downdraft across the shoals. Automatic weapons fire came at him, small arms only. None of it hit the skin. Rourke rotated the gunship a full 360 degrees again, and as he came online with the Soviet personnel, he opened fire with starboard forward-firing miniguns. The bullets laced across the shoals, across the snow. A long tongue of orange flame appeared on the video displays. The men began running downstream, slipping among the snow and ice-slicked rocks. John Rourke brought the gunship's nose around, passing over them now, a wash of water from the stream driven outward in a wake on both sides of the gunship, beating the Marine Spetsnaz personnel down. For all their 25th century submarine technology, they seemed as frightened as Stone Age men by the flying machine that spit death, ripped the water from the earth, and hurled it against them as if it were a wall.
Paul, this is John. If you cannot respond because of an equipment failure, I just hope you can hear me. I'm airborne now, confronting six armed Marine Spetsnaz personnel on the ground at our landing site. I should shortly have them subdued and we'll get whatever information possible. I will then proceed along your probable route. Look for me. I'll be looking for you. After this, there's no sense trying to hide. These six likely have radio capability and are equally likely to have reported presence of the gunship. Rourke out.
Rourke brought the German gunship out of the pass, banked to port, came around, then cut across the six Marine Spetsnaz line of flight, blocking their retreat. More sporadic gunfire came at the ship. Rourke felt the corners of his mouth raise in a smile. The skin of the gunship could be charged again, as it had been before he switched off the defense systems package preparatory to going airborne. He put power to the skin, then brought the gunship around, diving straight for them, following the stream bed, dropping altitude, increasing revolutions, streaking over them at maximum speed for the altitude and surrounding terrain. The wall of water that rose on either side of the gunship reacted against the electrically charged hull. Bolts of electricity surrounded the gunship in a whirlwind. The Marine Spetsnaz personnel scattered, throwing themselves toward the banks of the shallow stream. Rourke cut power to the skin, then hovered the craft over the Marine Spetsnaz personnel. They cowered beneath the gunship, the downdraft visibly tearing at their uniforms. John Rourke flipped the public address speaker.
Your weapons are useless. You are powerless to resist.
He assumed they had never seen the same B-movie science fiction thrillers he had.
Sam, have a few of your men lay back and cover us.
You heard the captain. You, Lanigan, you're in charge. Take him up into those rocks and cover us. Shoot anything in a Soviet uniform.
Yes, sir.
Lanigan gestured to both men, got them moving. Jason Darkwood stood at the foot of a chimney of rock. It was colder here in the higher elevations. There was evidence of much recent volcanic activity, at least geologically recent. Marine geology was part of the standard curriculum, since Midway depended for its minerals on mining the sea, and for its energy on geothermal faults. Surface geology seemed little different to him. He climbed rock chimneys in underwater caves in full diving gear back in his academy days and since for real purposes. He supposed, if anything, it might be easier doing it in more conventional attire on land. Evidently, the Marine Spetsnaz personnel who were now their prisoners had not come quite this way. More than he had ever realized before, Midway personnel desperately needed training in surface warfare. Something as simple as reading the terrain was a vital skill. When one essentially flew over the terrain by swimming, it wasn't as necessary. Darkwood looked at the Marine Spetsnaz prisoners. The Soviets had a decided advantage. Under similar circumstances, if the prisoners were not valuable to the Soviets, they would have been drugged nearly out of their minds and bound, left to freeze to death in the snow if it came to that, he supposed. Either that or killed outright. But the citizens of Midway labored under a different moral imperative. Despite the inconvenience at the moment, he would not have abandoned that. It was this moral imperative which lay as the foundation of his beliefs and those of his comrades and all citizens of Midway. He supposed it was this moral imperative that made Americans the good guys. Darkwood looked at his old friend Captain Sam Aldridge, USMC.
So just how many guys do we leave to guard our six unhappy Russian friends?
I detailed four men with instructions to shoot anyone who moved without permission, then reiterated those instructions in Russian for the benefit of the prisoners.
Darkwood chose to go first up the rock chimney. He unslung his pack and cinched the sling of his AKM-96 up tightly, then squeezed through. Aldridge handed the pack in after him. The rock seemed to radiate cold. Darkwood told himself that was psychological. He looked up. The chimney rose for perhaps 75 feet. All his climbing experience was in the water, except for climbing trees and things as a boy in the Midwake Nature Preserves. In water, there was buoyancy and buoyancy compensation, the force of gravity partially neutralized by buoyancy. He told himself that if he fell, he'd really get the feel for gravity here. Although the conditions were different, the technique would be the same. He snapped the end of his rope into his pack, then attached the other end to his belt, leaving the coil beside the pack, so he could haul the pack up after him. He braced himself inside the chimney, his right leg up, his left hand pressured, his left leg and right hand up. Right leg, left hand. Left leg, right hand. He repeated the process over and over again, not looking down at all until the chimney began narrowing. The narrowing was an advantage. He could use more body surface against the chimney walls, making himself at least feel more secure and actually speeding his progress. He was tiring more quickly than he would have underwater, he realized. He stopped approximately halfway up the chimney, catching his breath before going on. Paul Rubinstein found a gently sloping, easy path toward the promontory at the height of the ridgeline, from which the column of gray smoke originated. There was a breadloaf-shaped rock sitting on a shelf of rock extending toward a plateau that appeared recently made from a volcanic flow. As a boy, he liked geology well enough to become reasonably conversant in the field. In more than one school science fair, he used rock collections. It was made all the easier because his Air Force officer father would be transferred to a different base, and the new school hadn't seen the rock collection the previous year. His mother always made him do something new with it. His father, his mother, like uncounted millions of others, died during the Great Conflagration when the sky caught fire and nearly all surface life ceased. What would they think of him now? They had been proud of him. He shook his head, forced his thoughts away from his memories. They would have loved Annie, her being a Gentile notwithstanding. As he approached the peculiarly shaped rock, it was apparent there were two ways to get to the other side, over or around. Over it looked needlessly time-consuming, and because of the snow, dangerous. He walked around it, the M16 in his right fist, the Schmeisser submachine gun in his left. He felt like the hero in some pre-Night of the War adventure film. That he didn't look like any of them no longer really bothered him. He knew now that rippling muscles weren't a requirement for derring do, but granted, they would have helped at times. There was a peculiar odor to the smoke, something he had smelled before, but he couldn't remember when. The wind shifted and the odor was gone. Paul couldn't see the smoke now with the breadloaf-shaped rock between him and its source. Was it a signal fire? It certainly had attracted a considerable amount of attention. Perhaps all of this was nothing more than a group of stranded Russian seamen lighting a signal fire because they were marooned. Paul Rubinstein tried to imagine the Defoe classic with a communist flavor. Comrade Friday? At least Comrade Crusoe would be good alliteration. There was a variation on Robinson Crusoe done as a film he'd seen as a boy, the film set on Mars in some distant future. Paul reached the extreme end of the breadloaf-shaped rock. He dropped to his knees.
God of Abraham!
Tears filled his eyes. Six assault rifles, an assortment of individual weapons, and two RPGs lay at the feet of the stunned Marine Spetsnaz. Rourke climbed, using the public address system and warning the Marine Spetsnaz personnel below the German gunship.
Step back from your weapons, or you too will be destroyed.
The six men, including their non-com, ran. Rourke had cornered them, gotten them to disarm without landing. He never interrogated them. It seemed pointless to waste a missile destroying their weapons. Instead, he let the chopper turn 180 degrees on its axis, flew off and climbed, banked to port and dived, activating port and starboard forward miniguns. The twin bursts ripped across the pile of Soviet armament. The RPGs exploded as Rourke banked to starboard and climbed. He oriented and flew toward the column of smoke, looking for signs of Paul below him. At last, Jason Darkwood reached the height of the chimney. He could smell the smoke very strongly. There was something faintly sweet and faintly nauseating about it as he climbed out. He looked across a barren, volcanic rock flat.
Oh, Jesus.
Jason Darkwood could do nothing but stare, his throat tightening as he tried to fight back tears. Annie Rubenstein sat in a comfortable chair, her legs curled up almost under her. She reached toward Maggie Barrow's desk, took the small cup, and sipped at her tea.
Do you faint very often?
No.
Were you seeing what was going on in Major Chemerovna's thoughts, Annie?
Maybe. I think so.
And that made you faint?
Yes, I guess so.
What was it you saw, Annie?
My father's face, just coming in and out and disappearing and reappearing. There were flames and...
And so that?
No. Daddy always wears these aviator-style sunglasses with dark lenses. He must have a couple of dozen pairs of them at the retreat. He's very light-sensitive. Always has been. When the light hits them just right, you can see things in the lenses, like a reflection. I used to look at myself in them when I was a little girl, but this time I saw what Natalia was seeing in the glasses.
What was that, Annie?
It was a skull. A skull in each of the lenses, like death. That's what I saw.
Maggie Barrow folded her hands around her right knee as she sat on the edge of the desk and crossed her legs.
There's a man at Midwake, a very fine man. His name is Rothstein, Dr. Philip Rothstein. He's a psychiatrist, but he's so much more than that. I saw him do something once where he hypnotized somebody. Well, I was thinking, what if he hypnotized you and helped you clear your mind so that you could, well, like you say it, so you could enter Major Chemerovna's mind. As long as she remains catatonic, unless she can be brought out of it with drugs, I can't imagine how anyone can really help her. But if you were able to probe Major Chemerovna's mind, he could help.
My mind would be like a monitor for him to use.
Dr. Rothstein might not want to. It might be too dangerous for you.
Annie Rubenstein looked at her, sipped at the tea.
I'll try it. She did the same for me. She hadn't helped my father, none of us would be alive. When can we talk to this Dr. Rothstein?
Maggie Barrow didn't answer, just looked through the open office door. Annie's eyes tracked after her gaze. Natalia moved restlessly in a drug-induced sleep, her body bound to the bed with restraints so she could not hurt herself. Natalia was unable to do anything for herself. She was dead, though still alive. Annie told herself Paul would understand why she had to do this thing Dr. Barrow brought up. And if Dr. Rothstein at Midwake didn't want to help, then perhaps Dr. Munchen could find a similar specialist in New Germany. But just thinking of it, she felt like a thief waiting to strike. The mind was the repository of hopes and dreams, secret longings, and nightmares. And they were Natalia's private things, personal things. Did anyone have the right to look at them without her permission? Yet unless she miraculously snapped out of this, or there were some possible cure Maggie Barrow wasn't aware of, what then? Leave Natalia to spend weeks or months, years, perhaps the rest of her life, like she was now? Annie Rourke Rubenstein knew she would find her father there and Marshal Karamazov, and the night of the war. All of it, in reality and fantasy, and in ways she did not want to consider, because they frightened her. There was no sign of Paul as Rourke followed the ridgeline toward the summit and the source of the column of smoke. He followed the terrain with the machine to avoid making it easier for the island classer to track him, if indeed it had such capabilities at all. There was no doubt in his mind that someone from the party of six Marine Spetsnaz personnel he herded together and forced to disarm alerted the vessel prior to moving in. As Rourke brought the gunship over the ridgeline, he saw the source of the smoke. Surrounding it were a group of men, some in black uniforms that could have been Marine Spetsnaz or Midwake. From the altitude, he couldn't be certain. But standing with them, clearly, was Paul Rubenstein. They formed a ragged semicircle around the remains of a huge bonfire. But there were no trees anywhere on the slab of volcanic rock, and to have hauled wood to the center of the barren rock, rather than set the fire nearer to the ridgeline where there was timber closer at hand, seemed...
God, no.
John Rourke's hand froze on the stick, a sudden dry feeling in his mouth. He circled, the smoke dissipating in his downdraft. Paul Rubenstein waved him in.
Oh, this can't be.
He let the gunship settle over the plateau, slipping to port and down, leaving power to his main rotor. Paul walked toward him from the origin of the smoke. Beside him, a tall, lean, dark, curly-haired man, but the usual grin on the man's face gone. He and Paul wore almost the same expression. Rourke hit the release for his seat restraint, went to the fuselage door, opened it, and dropped down into the snow. Rourke didn't bother with a coat. His breath steamed. The wind cut through his black-knit shirt like a knife.
John!
Dr. Rourke, it's...
John Rourke walked ahead, the wind tearing at his hair. He pushed it back from his forehead. He walked between Paul and Jason Darkwood toward the bonfire.
John!
The smell of the smoke, twisted, contorted shapes still smoldering, blunted curves, thrusting angles, as if reaching.
John! They're people!
John Rourke turned away from the smoke. Vasily Prokopyev listened to the clicking of his own boot heels as he walked along the otherwise empty corridor toward the double doors at its end. It was too early for anyone, even in a predominantly military society such as that of the underground city. He stopped at the doors, gave a last look to his boots, a last tug to his uniform tunic, then opened the right-hand door, his uniform cap under his left arm. No secretary sat at the outer office desk, and only a single lamp at the head of the desk was turned on, illuminating the green blotter with a yellow wash. He closed the door behind him.
Major, is that you?
Yes, Comrade Colonel.
Prokopyev approached the inner office door. Here, no overhead lights shone either, but two lamps were lit at each side of the desk, and several feet away, one on each side of the picture of Lenin.
Have you ever been in this office before, Vasily?
The Comrade Colonel's chair was turned with the back facing toward the connecting doorway in which Prokopyev stood.
Once, Comrade Colonel. Then you will not blame me for the choice of decor.
As he spoke, the chair swung around 180 degrees, and Colonel Antonovich leaned forward across the littered desk, hands locking together as his fingers intertwined.
The hero marshal, as Vladimir Karamazov liked having himself called, had strange taste. That terrible picture of Nikolai Lenin, and yet the frame is plated with genuine gold. And the bar. One would have thought that our hero marshal was planning for another 5 centuries of survival. Only this time awake, at least to start with. Come in, and close the door behind you.
Prokopyev closed the door and then walked across the room. He stopped a meter from the desk and came to attention.
Stand easy. Take a seat, Vasily.
The Comrade Colonel shook his head.
I don't really know what to do with you. I mean, I know what I must do, but I read your report concerning the destruction of the second Chinese city, concerning the evacuation from their missile silo or temple.
Prokopyev felt he was not interrupting.
It was both, Comrade Colonel.
They are calling me Marshal these days.
Comrade Marshal.
Why did you include the information concerning John Rourke and Michael Rourke and their Jewish comrade, this Rubinstein fellow?
I felt, Comrade Marshal, that I should make an honest report.
Comrade Marshal Antonovich raised his head, smiled.
You have shown me that I am perhaps a better military commander than I might have supposed, Vasily. I desire to pick the best man possible, the best officer available to head the elite corps. And from among the KGB elite corps, seeking a truly honorable man can be a frustrating task. But it appears in you, I have indeed found such a man. Unfortunately, Vasily, you are also a fool. What would our late hero marshal have done to a member of the KGB elite corps who had several opportunities to kill John Thomas Rourke and did not?
I do not know.
You know, killing would have been too merciful. He might have eaten such a hapless person. Who knows? He was an animal. No wonder his wife left him for another man, if indeed she did. No, I would tear up this report of yours.
He raised a file folder from the litter of his desktop, fanned it for a moment, let it tumble from his hand to the desk, the papers inside spilling out.
But I cannot, because by now the chairman has a copy of this report, He will demand your arrest and trial and execution for treason. And I can do nothing to stop him. But you knew that when you composed your report.
Yes, Comrade Marshal.
And still, you wrote what you did.
Yes, Comrade Marshal, there is a trust I cannot violate.
The Comrade Marshal looked at him, smiled, and shook his head.
I don't suppose you are the sort of man who would choose suicide. No, death before dishonor certainly, but not suicide in a situation such as this.
That is correct, Comrade Marshal.
And what will you say at your trial, Vasily?
Comrade Marshal?
When you are asked why you, a major of the elite corps, its commander, why you allowed this wanted war criminal to go free, along with several other war criminals, why did you?
Comrade Marshal. His son saved my life. I met Dr. Rourke. He is a man of consummate bravery. He could not be the evil person he has been painted to be. I spoke with him. I fought beside him. He perhaps...
The hero Marshal, a courageous, honorable, and always truthful Vladimir Karamazov lied? See how far you get saying such a thing at a trial.
But...
Your wounds. You seem fit enough.
I will be.
There was no point in saying that he would be fine and recover perfectly. He knew his fate as he wrote the first word of his report, sealed that fate with his signature.
You will be dead, Vasily. Let me ask you a question. Who do you think is right?
Concerning what, Comrade Marshal?
I asked, who do you think is morally right? Ourselves or our enemies?
The Soviet people.
Now, Vasily, I said nothing about the Soviet people. I meant, based upon your experiences, who do you think is right? Is our side, the side of global communism, correct? Or whatever Dr. Rourke's side could be described as, is he correct? Is his side correct? What do you think?
The Soviet people are the most...
The finest and most courageous people. Yes, I know that. I speak philosophy, not of the people.
Vasily Prokopyev felt as if he were 12 years old and confronted by his schoolmaster.
You cannot get in any trouble, which could possibly be worse, Vasily.
Prokopyev nodded, looked at his hands, at his feet, up into the Comrade Marshal's oddly sympathetic-looking face.
I have come to believe that perhaps many things told to me as true might be lies, or distortions of the truth, at least.
You are remarkably astute. And?
Comrade Marshal?
Armed with this knowledge, what is your intention if somehow you should survive?
I do not know.
Well, let me enlighten you further. Before what your newfound friends refer to as the night of the war, the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics were moving toward mutual nuclear disarmament. There were certain factions within both countries, in fairness, which felt that such a policy was disaster, each distrusting the other, fearing the other, fearing weakness in themselves. Others lusted for power and saw war footing as the means by which to preserve existing power and increase their power. The hero, Marshal Karamazov, worked tirelessly, tirelessly, I say, to bring about destruction on a scale never before possible. There is a poem you will not have read nor have heard of by a poet whose name you will not know. He was English. John Milton. The poem spoke of the Judeo-Christian myth of paradise and is titled Paradise Lost. In this poem, the devil, the Judeo-Christian personification of ultimate evil as opposed to God, ultimate good, declares he would rather rule in hell than serve in heaven. And this apparently was the guiding principle of the hero Marshal back in the days when he was a colonel in the KGB, when he worked in what was then Latin America, in the Middle East, in the United States itself. Karamazov set about turning the earth into a hell over which he could rule. Where there was distrust, he wanted hatred. where there was the potential for violent upheaval, he wanted war. He, and to be fair, others like him succeeded, which is why you and I are contemporaries. I served under him in those days and saw his evil, did nothing. After he was shot down by John Rourke, I was one of those who brought him here, used the cryogenic sleep as a means of suspending debt, while all around us for 5 centuries there was birth and death and deprivation. I know of what I speak.
I knew that you were one of the...
His original disciples? Yes, I saw something here. A chairman who seeks war as desperately as Vladimir Karamazov sought it. A woman who slept with me because she wished to use me as a means of promoting this war. You must understand me.
The Comrade Marshal rose, standing behind his desk. He looked down on Prokopyev as if for emphasis.
I sought the missiles of the second Chinese city. I launched the global offensive. But I did all of this and will continue as Marshal of the Soviet Union because I sought what used to be called a Pax Romana. During the reign of Augustus Caesar in the old Roman Empire thousands of years ago, there was almost universal peace because there was almost universal government. My goal was to end war with war, not to risk the end of mankind. While someone else controlled the nuclear arsenal of pre-war China, there was the chance that it might be used as Karamazov planned to use it. But now, the chairman seeks to contact our supposed comrades beneath the sea, the antagonists of the Americans at Midway. He wishes to use their nuclear submarines and nuclear missiles. He has authorized the redevelopment of our 20th century particle beam device, with which Karamazov and Rozdestvenskaya after him intended to destroy the Eden Project and establish total Soviet rule. Rozdestvenskaya, according to documents unearthed by our archaeological teams at Cheyenne Mountain in American Colorado, personally ordered the deaths of ranking Soviet officials coming to the womb for their own survival. He did this in order to ensure his own power. The particle beam technology is now so advanced that these weapons can be mounted on armored vehicles, in helicopter gunships, made in any size or power range. Soon they will be adapted as infantry machine guns. No weapon short of nuclear weapons will stand against them. With the nuclear potential of the Soviet civilization beneath the sea and the particle beam technology, all resistance will be destroyed. There will be an empire of death. If the Earth is not totally destroyed when the first nuclear weapon is used, and the Germans of New Germany and Argentina are developing nuclear weapons for their defense, the Soviet people will be the only people who will survive. But they will survive to live under the most despotic rule in human history, and still, there will be no peace. Will the chairman surrender authority to the nuclear-capable new comrades after their enemies at Midway and our enemies have all been destroyed? I think he will not. Instead, there will be war again. It will not end until the Earth ends.
Prokopyev watched the Comrade Marshal's eyes.
Why do you tell me this, Comrade Marshal?
You, Vasily, are in a unique position.
A pistol appeared in Antonovich's right hand, almost as if he had pulled it from thin air. It was very small, and likely very old.
This is a 25-caliber Beretta, in answer to your unspoken question. It is almost as old as I am. You are here because you are an honorable man, honorable to the point of willingly surrendering your life because it is the morally correct thing to do. I wish for you to leave me with this in your pocket.
The Comrade Marshal produced a small object about the size of a small spool of thread.
There is film inside this canister. The film contains the plans for the particle beam devices which will soon be used in the field against the allies of Dr. Rourke. Make no mistake, Vasily. I am a loyal communist. I shall continue to defend the Soviet people to the best of my ability. But my answer, I have realized, and it has taken me 5 centuries to come to this realization, my answer is not the best answer. Will you serve the Soviet people and all the people?
How, Comrade Marshal?
Dr. Rourke is a man like you, a man of honor, and it would appear from your report, so is his son. Give this film to him and tell him that I trust he will do the right thing. Will you take it?
How can I?
You are the most highly trained man in the elite corps. I cannot believe you could not find a way, Vasily.
Prokopyev looked at his hands. They trembled slightly.
Yes, Comrade Marshal.
The Comrade Marshal tossed the film canister across the desk. Prokopyev watched it come toward him as if it were in slow motion. He caught it in his right hand. His hand no longer trembled.
I have two messages for you. Tell Comrade Major Chimarovna that perhaps she was right about me after all. She always told me I was not born to Karamazov's work.
Comrade Marshal,
Yes. And tell Dr. Rourke this changes nothing. I would kill him if I had the chance. And I will expect the same courtesy from him. There is a pack. There are winter clothes. There is a fine knife. There is a pistol, an assault rifle, adequate ammunition, foodstuffs, and personal medical supplies. Do what you must. If you take a life from within the elite corps, it will be one less to hunt you down and kill you. Remember that communism, if it is good, is to serve the people, living people. Now, take the film. Guard it against any sort of radiation. Take this pistol and shoot me in the arm with it. In the fleshy part. Here.
He set the pistol on the desk, then touched his outer left forearm. Prokopyev picked up the pistol. It was very small.
The hammer is already cocked, Vasily. The gun shoots true at short range. There is little muzzle blast. We fought over the gun, of course. You took it and attempted to kill me, but I shoved you away and that deflected your bullet. The safety catch is on the left-hand side. Push it down. Watch for the web of your hand as you shoot. It is a very small gun. Shoot me.
Vasily Prokopyev raised the pistol, took a single step, hesitated, and took another step back. He aimed the pistol. It had very rudimentary sights at the Comrade Marshal's outstretched left arm. His thumb found the safety catch and he pushed it down as instructed. Why would anyone wish a gun so small?
Yes, Comrade Marshal.
The Comrade Marshal fell back against the picture of Lenin, clasping his left forearm. The Comrade Marshal smiled. It was necessary, after trying to connect the pieces as well as possible, to rope the dead down through the rock chimney. A mass grave would have been impossible to dig on the volcanic flow. 120 men were detailed to the surface warfare group on Iwo Jima. The remains of as many as 50 were in the giant bonfire, parts of it still reeking of something that smelled like gasoline and which the men of Midwake identified as the Soviet equivalent of napalm. There were the remains of plastic ropes, not fully burned, and there was no evidence any of the men had been shot before being set afire. The evidence, on the contrary, seemed clear that the men were executed in the flames, by the flames. Once their bodies were roped down, the team dug the grave. No one suggested that the six Soviet prisoners assist. It would have seemed, Paul Rubinstein reflected, to dishonor the dead. John Rourke interrogated the prisoners. The remaining survivors of the attack on Iwo Jima were being transported, walked, through the jungle, stripped of their uniforms, hence freezing, toward the island-class submarine anchored off the island. They would be taken by the Soviets for scientific experiments. The Soviet undersea colony had been practicing surface warfare for the last decade, been aware of the Iwo Jima facility for 6 months at least. They decided to leave a message for the people of Midwake, one they would never forget. Paul Rubinstein agreed with that. The message would never be forgotten.
We have two choices.
Paul Rubinstein listened as he, John Rourke, Jason Darkwood, and Sam Aldridge walked toward the helicopter gunship. The six Soviet prisoners and the rest of Aldridge's Marines waited uneasily near the rock chimney. The Soviet prisoners had to be terrified they would be executed in like manner to the Americans from Midwake, or worse. And the Marines had to be tempted.
Are they the same two choices I'm thinking of, Dr. Rourke?
I would imagine they are.
With Mrs. Rubinstein, Major Chemerovna, and Captain Hammerschmidt safe, you and your flying machine are capable of pursuing other interests.
That's right, Captain. Revenge sounds like a really good start.
Can this gunship...
Darkwood gestured toward the German craft.
Can it destroy an island-classer, Doctor?
With a great deal of luck, yes. I know what the German missiles will do against Soviet surface armor. I have no idea what they'll do against a double hull capable of withstanding the depths these vessels routinely sustain. However, with a great deal of luck, yes, I can probably destroy it. Or with a little assistance and less luck, I know I can destroy it. We'll have to free the prisoners first, of course. Have to free them so that if we do get the island class to blow, when she does, their captors won't automatically massacre the prisoners. And we'll have to do it very quickly. The rescue, I mean. So they won't have time to radio the island class that we're getting them. The island class knows about the helicopter, but probably has very little understanding of its abilities. At best, computer records might give a breakdown of the abilities of late 20th century helicopter gunships. This German version is vastly quicker, more maneuverable, better, and more heavily armed. They couldn't expect that, at least not without some good minds going to work on it, and there won't have been time for that either.
John stopped beneath the now still blades of the main rotor.
Now, I think we have a chance. The six men you took prisoner are the key. From your account, Captain, of their capture, they couldn't possibly have radioed in their predicament. Therefore, they're still expected. Even considering the time we spent at the burial, we can get them to the right spot using the helicopter, making up for the lost time.
Get us, you mean?
We put on their uniforms, walk right up to them.
No, that suntan routine worked last time, Sam. You control the second element for the ambush.
Assuming we get the rest of the Midwake personnel free, what, 70 or so?
Aside from casualties. They might have been heavy. Probably were. Most of the people here were Marines.
Then assuming we get them free, what if we salvage as many additional uniforms as possible? Then walk the Midwake personnel aboard the island-class submarine. Instead of you blowing it, John, why not take it?
John Rourke turned and looked at him.
That's very simple and very brilliant, Paul.
Oh. No U.S. skipper has boarded a major enemy vessel during an action since the U-505 submarine during World War II. I mean, that island class who we hijacked wasn't manned, wasn't...
Darkwood referred to the vessel he and Sam Aldridge and a handful of Marine raiders stole during their rescue of Natalia from Midwake. Aldridge interrupted Paul's thoughts.
Well, don't forget those little scout subs my people took. But you're right, Jace.
How's that island-class submarine you and your men took doing anyway?
Well, now that you bring it up, I understand it's getting very lonely for one of its own kind. In a way, we'd be performing a humanitarian act. Not to mention probably netting ourselves a full complement of Soviet missiles.
Paul Rubinstein watched as John Rourke turned away from the gunship and stared back toward the six prisoners.
That Soviet Marine Spetsnaz sergeant. He's a big one. That might be why he didn't give in entirely to the truth drug. Or maybe he really had no knowledge of the burning of the prisoners and couldn't tell us. At least I can hope. It wouldn't be convincing to put someone into his uniform. And anyway, the bloodstains on the other uniforms weren't so bad. I think it'll just have to be the five of us. You, Captain, Paul here, myself, and two other of your men.
Falling, blowing snow swirled in kaleidoscopic patterns in the light. Michael Rourke's flashlight showed solid rock, but Bjorn Rolvag tapped him on the shoulder and gestured that they should move ahead. Michael switched off the flashlight and followed him. The snow that seemed to fall everywhere, according to the German meteorological reports, was a blizzard here. Michael Rourke doubted that even with Rolvag's expertise in Arctic travel and survival, and the aid of his dog, Hrothgar, they would be able to go on much farther, nor be able to turn back. Maria was roped behind him, Michael following Rolvag, Maria and the German commandos and volunteers from the German Hekla base following him. Struggling through the snow, the dog would be there one instant and gone into the blizzard the next, totally lost from sight, only then returning to run off once more. It crossed Michael's mind that perhaps Rolvag's head injury was more serious than anyone knew, that he was simply leading them into the blizzard out of delusion. Michael could feel Maria Leuden beside him, feel the pressure of her heavily gloved hands on his forearm. He wrapped his arm around her, trudged ahead, the snowdrifts at times waist high, the temperature so cold that his thighs, despite the several layers of thermal clothing, were stiffening, his legs almost refusing to move. Bjorn Rolvag was clearly a driven man. Every instinct in Rolvag's body must have been telling him to press on, to find this tunnel, whether it existed or not, penetrate the tunnel, reach the interior of the Hekla Cone, and rush to the rescue of his country's leader, Madame Jokli.
I'm so cold, Michael.
Michael held her tighter, kept moving.
Just keep moving!
Turning back was pointless. Where was back? Michael kept moving, slamming into what felt like a wall. It was Bjorn Rolvag, swathed in his furs, Hrothgar bounding back and forth in the cone of Michael's flashlight as he turned it on. There was no chance that the Russian occupation forces might have had sentries at the height of the cone who could see the light. Visibility was nearly measurable in inches, certainly only in feet. Rolvag pointed into the darkness beyond the snow that swirled in Michael's light, and then started toward... what? Michael saw nothing. Rolvag moved on, Michael in his wake, almost dragging Maria, ready to take her up into his arms and carry her, because he realized she could go no farther, really. If they were attacked now, even assuming they could tell from which direction, he doubted his M16's bolt could be cleared of ice quickly enough to fire back. His other weapons were beneath his parka, hopeless to get to, his hands numb and stiff. Michael slammed into rock, stumbled, dragging Maria Lloyden down into the snow with him. But as he reached out, there was nothing there. He swept his hand right and left. To the right, there was rock. Michael pulled himself to his knees, then to his feet.
I think it's the tunnel, Maria.
He pulled her to her feet, feeling the forward pressure of Rolvag's rope tugging him ahead. He took a step, then another, and another, and then... a lit lantern moved. In its light, he could see Rolvag's face. There was no snow around his face. They were inside the tunnel. Bjorn Rolvag's broad face seamed with a smile. Since it was Colonel Mann's personal J-7V, the aircraft was furnished rather differently from the others in which Sarah Rourke had flown. His J-7V, for example, although a fighter craft, had a complete radio room in the rear of the fuselage. She gathered it was far more than ordinary radio. More likely, sophisticated electronic intelligence equipment racks. He emerged from the back of the plane now, looking troubled. She liked him very much as a person, as a friend. He treated her as a person and friend. She liked that as well.
Frau Rourke, Sarah, your friend, Lieutenant Korinami, he is now listed as officially missing in action and presumed dead. The men whose lives he saved have personally conducted an air search. They had to turn back because of the storms raging in the southeastern United States and because of significant and growing Soviet presence. Nothing was seen of him. I hate to be the bearer of such news, Sarah.
Sarah Rourke stared out the cabin window of the J-7V.
Wolf, would you try something for me?
He sat down opposite her, leaning toward her, his hands near her coffee cup.
If I can, of course.
When Akiro and Elaine Halverson, his fiancée, when they escaped from Commander Dodd before, they went to the retreat. I wouldn't feel as if everything had been done if somehow we didn't go there. Make an aerial search of the surrounding area if possible, and go to the retreat itself. He could be there, perhaps injured or dying. It's worth a chance, isn't it, Wolfgang?
Wolfgang Mann nodded slowly.
Yes, it is worth a chance. The aerial search may prove impossible, but we can try. If the pilot is not willing to try a landing, I will. Unless it would mean the deaths of all aboard. Yes.
He looked at his watch.
We won't be over northeastern Georgia for better than 40 minutes. Then we will know. So sleep now. I can get a blanket for you.
Thank you. Where are we now? About, I mean.
We passed over the St. Lawrence River not long ago. I imagine we are somewhere near where your New York City once was.
She looked into the darkness, imagining they were flying over New York City, her New York City. That made her smile, but her New York City sparkled with lights, beautiful lights. She was sure she could have seen them through the snow she knew was falling below them. She was sure. But now, there was just darkness. She turned more toward the window so he wouldn't see her cry. Her hand laid on her growing abdomen. A little boy. Another John, another Michael. More fodder for a history likely no one would survive to read. Her tears flowed freely now, and she hadn't thought that Wolfgang Mann was still watching her.
May I?
As he placed his arm around her shoulders, holding her tight enough to be reassuring, comforting, but not tight enough that it would be misinterpreted, Sarah Rourke realized what she was, a widow with a living husband. And she was very lonely. But when she closed her eyes tight against the tears, she could see the lights. Vasily Prokopyev knew the underground city. He was born there, raised there in the communal center for boys who showed an aptitude for military service. At age 14, he was transferred from the General Military Studies program to the special program, which of course was for the KGB. With the special program came a special school. The curriculum was very demanding, from code-breaking skills to marksmanship to interrogation improvisations to chemical composition of poisons and explosives. And always, physical training. But if studies went well and discipline was maintained, each boy had his day. Prokopyev always applied himself to his studies, whether he perceived the specific subject matter as boring or exciting, useful or absurd. One afternoon and early evening each weekend was his. Sharp-looking in his gray uniform, black boots, black belt, and his cap, he would move about the underground city, watching, of course, for pretty girls, hoping they were watching back. The prettiest girls seemed to be those from the musical studies or dancing schools, but sometimes a surprisingly pretty girl could be found in the oddest place, loading sacks of grain, learning how to artificially inseminate one of the precious farm animals, driving a delivery truck, or, one of the most unlikely places, in the sewers. Back then, Vasily and his best friend Ivan spent a lot of time adventuring in the city's sewer system. It was a far cry from the medieval tunnels found in pre-war cities. Here it was so spotlessly clean, one could eat off the tunnel floors except for the fact that maintenance personnel walked there. The tunnels only served as access to the sewer pipes, interconnected throughout the entire area of the underground city's primary level. It also connected to the various buildings of the city. The two boys spent hours imagining themselves as commandos, figuring out how to breach the defenses of shadow enemies. Walking quickly through the sewer system now, memories were Vasily Prokopyev's only companions.
Where is Ivan now? What would he think of my mission?
Prokopyev carried film given him by Marshal Antonovich that could be used by enemies of the state, but for the good of the Soviet people. Would Ivan have called this treason? He didn't think so. Would Ivan have done the same thing? He thought so. The pack he wore was heavy, but he had carried heavier. The weapons left for him were of the best quality, a vintage CZ-75 pistol, one of those Antonovich himself likely ordered preserved in the gummy petroleum-based preservative known as cosmoline. Since these guns were still carried as prized possessions by many of the officer corps, handed down from father to son, their 9mm ammunition was still manufactured in limited quantities.
Why did the marshal give me such a pistol? Was it some sort of symbol? It is beyond me to understand.
The knife was one of the handmade fighting knives usually carried by officers who had never fought and never would, but finely crafted in the American Bowie pattern. The assault rifle was standard issue. For both the rifle and pistol, he was provided extra magazines and what almost seemed like too much ammunition. Perhaps the comrade marshal assumed that he, Prokopyev, would have to fight his way out of the underground city. Such a scenario was certainly possible because the sewer system only went so far, and then he would have to exit the system and attempt to leave by one of the lesser used entrances. There would be guards. He outranked them, but they would wonder why he was in battle uniform and wearing field equipment and all alone. He would attempt to bluff his way through, explain he was on some special mission. If that worked, he would be out without bloodshed. If it did not work, they would ask for his papers. Comrade Marshal Antonovich provided no such papers, could not have, without implicating himself.
In that case, I must fight.
He walked on, listening to the sounds of his breathing, the clicking of his boot heels on the flooring beneath him.
Can I shed Soviet blood?
He knew he might have to find out.